wretched man was hanged and burned, all the sheep died 4 days later. Just dropped in the fields. Folks said it was his family's revenge, but when they went for vengeance against his kin, they found them long gone. There was a scroll left tacked to the door of their house. All it said was, "You deserved it." There have been other incidences as well. I met her eyes. "So Hap told me," I admitted. She nodded curtly. She rose from the table and stepped clear of it. A minstrel to the bone, she had a story to tell and demanded a stage for it. Well, after Sleck sang the Piebald Prince, another minstrel came forwards. He was very young, and perhaps that was why he was so foolish. He doffed his cap to Queen Catrican, and then said he would follow the Piebald Prince with another song of more recent vintage. When he said that he'd heard it first in a hamlet of witted folk, muttering ran through the crowd. All have heard rumours of such places, but never have I heard someone claim to have been to one. When the mutter died, he launched into a song I'd never heard before. The tune was derivative, but the words were new to me. As raw as his voice. She cocked her head at me and regarded me speculatively. This song was of chivalry's bastard. It touched on all he had done before his witted taint was revealed. He even stole a phrase or two from my song of Antler Island Tower, if you can believe the gall of that. Then this song went on that this farseer's son, with old blood blessed, of royal blood and wild the best, had not died in the pretender's dungeon. According to this song, the bastard had lived and had been true to his father's family. The minstrel sang that when King Verity went off to seek the elderlings, the bastard rose from his grave to rally to his rightful king's aid. The minstrel sang a stirring scene of how the bastard called Verity back through the gates of death to show him a garden of stone dragons that could be wakened to the six duchies' cause. That, at least, had the ring of truth to it. It made me sit up and wonder, even if his voice was growing hoarse by then. She paused, waiting for me to speak. But I had no words. She shrugged, then observed caustically, "If you wanted a song made of those days, you might have thought of me first. I was there, you know. In fact, it was why I was there. And I am a far better minstrel than that boy was." There was a quiver of jealous outrage in her voice. "I had nothing to do with that song, as I'm sure you must realize. I wish no one had ever heard it." "Well, you've little enough to worry about there," she said, the words with deep satisfaction. "I'd never heard it before that day, nor since." "It was not well made. The tune did not fit the theme. The words were ragged, the starling." "Oh, very well." He gave the song the traditional heroic ending that if ever the Farseer crown demanded it, the true-hearted, witted bastard would return to the aid of the kingdom. At the end of the song, some of the Springfest crowd yelled insults at him, and someone said he was likely witted himself and fit for burning. Queen Catrican commanded them to silence, but at the end of the evening, she gave him no purse as she did the other minstrels. I kept silent, passing no judgment on that. When I did not rise to her bait, Starling added, "because he had vanished when it came for her time to reward those who pleased her. She called his name first, but no one knew where he had gone. His name was unfamiliar to me, Tagson." Son of Tag, grandson of Reva, I could have told her. And both Reva and Tag had been very able members of Verity's Buckkeep Guard. My mind reached back through the years to find Tag's face as he knelt before Verity in the stone garden, before the gates of death. Yes, so I suppose it had looked to him, Verity stepping out from the stark black skill pillar and into the uncertain circle of the firelight. Tag had recognized his king, despite all hardship had done to Verity. He had proclaimed his loyalty to him, and Verity had sent him on his way, bidding him return to Buckkeep and tell all there that the rightful king would return. In thinking back on it, I was almost certain that Verity had arrived at Buckkeep before the soldier did. dragons a-wing are a deal faster than a man on foot. I had not known Tag had recognized me as well. Who could ever have foreseen he would pass on that tale, let alone that he would have a minstrel for a son?
"I see that you know him," Starling said quietly.
I glanced at her to find her eyes reading my face greedily. I sighed. "I know no Tag, son. I'm afraid my mind wandered back to something you said earlier. The Witted have grown restless. Why?" She lifted an eyebrow at me.
"I thought you would better know than I."
I lead a solitary life, Starling, as well you know. I'm in a poor position to hear tidings of any kind save what you bring me. It was my turn to study her, and this was information you never shared with me. She looked away from me, and I wondered, had she decided to keep it from me? Had Chade bid her not speak of it to me? Or had it been crowded from her mind by her stories of nobles she had played for and acclaim she had received?
"It isn't a pretty tale. I suppose it began a year and a half ago. Perhaps two. It seemed to me that I had begun to hear more often of witted ones being found out and punished, or killed. You know how people are, Fitz. For a time after the Red Ship War, I am sure they had their glut of killing and blood. But when the enemy is finally driven far from your shore, and your houses are restored, and your fields begin to yield, and your flocks to increase, why then, it becomes time to find fault with your neighbours again. I think Regal wakened a lust for blood sport in the Six Duchies, with his king's circle and justice by combat. I wonder if we shall ever be truly free of that legacy."
She touched an old nightmare. The king's circle at Tradeford, the caged beasts and the smell of old blood, trial by battle, the memory washed through me, leaving sickness in its wake.
2 years ago.
"Yes," Starling continued. She moved restlessly about the room as she considered it. "That was when the old hatred of wicked folk started up again. The Queen spoke out against it, for your sake, I imagine. She is a beloved Queen, and she has wrought many changes during her rule. But in this, tradition runs too deep. The folk in the village think, well, what can she know of our ways, mountain bred as she is? So although Queen Catrican did not countenance it, the hounding of the witted went on as it always has. Then, in Trenury in Farrow, about a year and a half ago, there was a horrifying incident. As the story came to Buckkeep, a witted girl had a fox as her beast, and she cared not where it hunted so long as the blood ran every night." I interrupted her. "A pet fox? Not exactly common. It was even more suspect that the girl who had this fox was neither of noble blood nor wealthy. What business had a farmer's child with such a beast? The rumours spread. The poultry flocks of the village near Trenury suffered the most, but the final blow was when something got into Lord Doplin's aviary and made dinner of his songbirds and imported rain wildfowl. He sent his huntsman after the girl and fox said to be at the root of it, and they were run down, not gently, and brought before Lord Doplin. She swore it was none of her fox's doing. She swore she was not witted. But when the hot irons were put on the fox, it said that she screamed as loudly as the beast did. Then, to close the circle of his proof, Doplin had the nails drawn from the girl's fingers and toes, and the fox likewise shrieked with her."
A moment. Her words dizzied me. I could imagine it too well.
"I shall finish it swiftly. They died slowly. But the next night, more of Doplin's songbirds were slain, and an old huntsman said it was a weasel, not a fox. For the weasel but drinks the blood, whereas a fox would have taken the birds to pieces. I think it was the injustice of her death, as much as the cruelty of it, that roused the witted against him. The next day, Doplin's own dog snapped at him. Doplin had both his dog and his dog boy put down. He claimed that when he walked through his stables, every one of his horses went wild-eyed at his passage, laying back ears and kicking their stall walls. He had two stable boys hanged over water and burned. He claimed flies began to flock to his kitchen so that he found them daily dead in his food, and that..." I shook my head at her. "That is the wildness of a man's uneasy conscience, not the work of any witted ones I have ever known." She shrugged.
In any case, the folk cried out to the queen for justice when over a dozen of his lesser servants had been tortured or killed, and she sent Chade. I leaned back in my chair and crossed my arms on my chest. So, the old assassin was still the bearer of the far-seer justice. I wondered who had accompanied him to do the quiet work. "What happened?" I asked, as if I did not know. Chade made a simple solution to it all. By the Queen's order, he forbade Duplin to keep horse, hawk, or hound, or beast or bird of any kind in his manor. He cannot ride, hawk, or hunt in any form. Chade even forbade him and all who live in his keep the eating of any flesh or fish for a year. That will make for a dreary holding. It is said amongst the minstrels that no one guests with Duplin any more, unless they must, that his servants are few and surly, and that he has lost his stature with the other nobles since his hospitality has become such a threadbare welcome. And Chade forced him to pay blood gold, not only to the families of the slain servants, but to the family of the fox girl. Did they take it? The servants' families did. It was only fair. The fox girl's family were gone, dead or fled. No one would say. Chade demanded that the blood money for her be given to the queen's counting man, to be held for the family. She shrugged. It should have settled it. But from the time to now, the incidents have multiplied. Not just the scourings for the witted ones, but the revenge the witted wreak in turn for their torments. It should have settled it. But from that time to now, the incidents have multiplied. Not just the scourings for witted ones, but the revenge the witted wreak in turn on their tormentors. I frowned. I don't see why any of that would provoke further uprising amongst the witted. It seems to me Duplin was justly punished, and some say more severely than he deserved. But Chade was unrelenting. Nor did he stop with that. Shortly after that, all six dukes received scrolls from Queen Catrican saying that to be witted was no crime, save that a witted one used it for evil ends. She told the dukes that they must forbid their nobles and lords to execute witted ones, save that their crimes had been proven against them as surely as any ordinary man's crimes. The edict did not sit well, as you can imagine. Where it is not ignored, proof of a man's guilt is always ample after his death. Instead of calming feelings, the Queen's declaration seemed to wake all the old feelings against the witted ones. But, among the witted, it has seemed to rally them to defiance. They do not suffer their blood to be executed without a fight. Sometimes they are content merely to free their own before they can be killed, but often enough they strike back in vengeance. Almost any time there is an execution of a witted one, some evil swiftly befalls those responsible. Their cattle die, or diseased rats bite their children. Always it has to do with animals. In one village, the river fish they depended on simply did not migrate that year. Their nets hung empty, and the folk went hungry. Ridiculous. Folk claim happenstance is malice. The witted do not have the kind of powers you were ascribing to them. I spoke with great surety. She gave me a disdainful look. Then why do the piebalds claim credit for such acts if the work is not theirs? The piebalds? Who were the piebalds? She lifted one shoulder and a shrug. No one knows. They do not announce themselves. They leave messages pegged to indoors or trees and send missives to the nobles. They always sing the same tune with different words. Such a one was killed unjustly, for no crime but merely for possessing old blood magic. Now our wrath falls on you. When the piebald prince returns, he will have no mercy on you. And it is signed with no name, but only an image of a piebald stallion. It makes folk furious. The queen has refused to send out her guard to hunt them down, so now the gossiping among some of the nobility is that Queen Catrican herself is at fault for the increased executions of witted ones. For her punishing of Lord Duplin has made them think that they have the right to their perverted magic. At my scowl, she reminded me, a minstrel but repeats what she has heard. I do not create the rumours nor put words in people's mouths.
She came closer to me, and from behind me she set her hands on my shoulders. She bent down, her cheek by mine.
Gently, she added, after all the years we have been together, surely you know by now that I do not consider you tainted.
She kissed my cheek. Our current conversation had almost driven my resolve from my mind. Nearly, I took her in my arms. Instead, I stood, awkwardly, for she was right behind my chair. When she tried to embrace me, I chilled my heart. I set her at arm's length from me.
You are not mine,
I told her quietly.
Nor am I his.
She blazed at me suddenly. Her dark eyes shone with her anger.
I belong to myself, and I shall decide who shares my body. It hurts nothing for me to be with both of you. I will not get pregnant by either of you. If any man could get me with child, it would have happened long ago. So what does it matter whose bed I share?
She was quick-witted, and words served her tongue far better than mine. I had no clever reply, so I echoed her own words.
I, too, belong to myself, and I decide who will share my body, and I will not share it with another man's wife.
I think then that she finally believed it. I had set her belongings in a neat pile beside the hearth. She flung herself to her knees beside it. Snatching up her saddle pack, she began to stuff it furiously.
I don't know why I ever bothered with you, she muttered.
Mishap, true to his name, chose that moment to enter the cabin. The wolf was at his heels. At the sight of Starling's angry face, Hap turned to me.
Should I leave?
He asked boldly.
No, Starling spat the word. You get to stay. I'm the one he's throwing out, thanks to you. You might ponder a moment or two, Hap, on what would have become of you if I had left you digging in that village garbage heap. I deserved gratitude from you, not this betrayal.
The boy's eyes went wide. Nothing she had ever done, not even how she had deceived me, angered me as much as witnessing her hurt him. He gave me a stricken look as if he expected I, too, would turn on him. Then he bolted out of the door. Night Eyes gave me a baleful look, then spun to follow him. I'll come soon. Let me finish this first.
Better you had never started it.
I let his rebuke hang unanswered, for there was no good reply to it.
Starling glared up at me, and as I glowered back, I saw something almost like fear pass over her face.
I crossed my arms on my chest.
Best you were gone, I said tightly.
The wary look in her eye was as great an insult to me as the abuse she had flung at Hap. I left the cabin and went to fetch her horse. A fine horse and a fine saddle, doubtless both gifts from a fine young man. The animal sensed my agitation and pranced restlessly as I saddled her. I took a breath, gathered control over myself, and set my hand to the horse. I sent calmness to her. In doing so, I calmed myself. I stroked her sleek neck. She turned to waffle her nose against my shirt. I sighed.
Take care of her, would you? For she takes no care with herself.
I had no bond with the creature, and my words were only reassuring sounds to her. I sensed in return her acceptance of my mastery. I led her to the front of the cottage and stood outside, holding her reins. In a moment, Starling appeared on the porch.
Can't wait for me to leave, can you?
She observed bitterly. She threw her pack across the saddle, unsettling the horse once more.
That's not true, and you know it, I replied.
I tried to keep my voice level and calm. The pain I had been denying broke through my humiliation at how gullible I had been, and my anger that she had used me so. Our bond had not been a tender, heartfelt love. Rather, it had been a companionship that had included the sharing of our bodies and the trust of sleeping in one another's arms. The betrayal of a friend differs from the treachery of a lover only in the degree of pain, not the kind. I suddenly knew I had just lied to her. I desperately wanted her to leave. Her presence was like an arrow standing in a wound. It could not be healed until she was gone. Nevertheless, I tried to think of some significant words, something that would salvage the good part of what we had shared.
but nothing came to me. And in the end I stood dumbly by as she snatched the reins from my hand and mounted. She looked down on me from the animal's back. I'm sure she felt some pain, but her face showed only her anger, that I had thwarted her will. She shook her head at me. You could have been someone, regardless of how you were born. They gave you every chance of making something of yourself. You could have mattered. But this is what you chose. Remember that. You chose this. She tugged the horse's head around. Not so badly as to injure her mouth, but rougher than she needed to be. Then she kicked the horse to a trot and rode away from me. I watched her go. She did not look back. Despite my pain, I felt not the regret of an ending, but the foreboding of a beginning. A shiver ran over me, as if the fool himself stood at my elbow and whispered words at my ear. Do you not sense it? A crossroads, a vertex, a vortex. All paths change from here. I turned, but there was no one there. I glanced at the sky. Dark clouds were hastening from the south. Already the tips of the trees were stirring with the oncoming squall. Starling would begin her journey with a drenching. I told myself I took no satisfaction in that, and went looking for Hap. Chapter 4. The Hedge Witch. There was a hedge witch in those parts, Silver Copperleaf by name, whose charms were of such a strength that their potency lasted not just from year to year, but continued to protect the folk who possessed them for generations. It is said that she made for Baldric Farseer a marvellous sieve, such that it purified all waters that passed through it. This was a great boon for a king so often threatened by poisoners. Above the gate of the walled town of Eccles, she hung a charm against pestilence, and for many years the grain bins were free of rats, and the stables clean of fleas and other vermin. The town prospered under this protection, until the town elders foolishly built a second gate in their walls to admit more trade. This opened a way for pestilence to enter the town, and all there perished from the second wave of the blood plague. Selkin's Travels in the Six Duchies. High summer found Hap and me just as it had found us for the last 7 years. There was a garden to tend, poultry to mind, and fish to salt and smoke against winter's need. Day followed day in its round of chores and meals, sleeping and walking. Starling's departure, I told myself, had effectively quenched the restlessness that Chade's visit had sparked. I had spoken to Hap in a desultory way of putting him out to an apprenticeship. With an enthusiasm that surprised me, he told me of a cabinet maker in Buckkeep whose work he had greatly admired. I balked at that, having no desire to visit Buckkeep town, but I think he suspected I could not pay such a high apprentice fee as a fine workman like Gindast could demand. In that he was likely correct. When I asked him of any other woodworkers he had noticed, he stoutly replied that there was a boat builder in Hammerby Cove whose work was often praised. Perhaps we might try there. This was a far humbler master than the cabinet maker in Buckkeep. I uneasily wondered if the boy was not tailoring his dreams to the depths of my pockets. His apprenticeship would determine the course of his life's work. I didn't want my lack of coin to condemn him to a trade he found merely tolerable. Yet despite the boy's interest, the apprenticeship remained a topic for late-night talks by the hearth and little more. Oh, I set aside a small store of coins that remained to me against apprentice fee. I even told the boy that we would make do with fewer eggs for meals if he wished to let the hens set some. There was always a market for chickens, and whatever he got for them he could save towards his fee. Even then I wondered if it would be enough to buy him a good place. Willing hands and a strong back could buy a lad an apprenticeship, it was true, but the better artisans and craftsmen usually demanded a fee before they would take a likely boy into their shops. It was the way of Buck. The secrets of a man's trade, and the good livelihood he made at it, were not to be carelessly given to strangers. If parents loved their children, they either raised them in their own trades, or paid well to see them apprenticed to those who had mastered other arts. Despite the humbleness of our fortunes, I was determined to see Hap well-placed. That, I told myself, was why I delayed. to muster more coin. It was not that I dreaded parting with the boy, only that I wished to do well by him. The wolf did not ask me about the journey I had earlier proposed. I think that, in his heart, he was relieved to see it postponed. There were days when I felt that Starling's word had made an old man of me. Years had done that, in truth, to the wolf. I suspected he was very old for his kind, though I had no idea of how long a wild wolf usually lived. I wondered sometimes if our bond did not lend him an unnatural vitality. Once it even crossed my mind that perhaps he used up my years to lengthen his own, yet that thought came not with any resentment that he might borrow my days, but with hope that we might still have a good long span together. For once the boy was apprenticed out, whom else did I have in the world besides Night Eyes? For a time I wondered if Chade might come to call again, now that he knew the way, but the long days of summer simmered away, and the trail to our cabin remained empty. I went to market with the boy twice, taking fledged chickens and my inks and dyes and such roots and herbs as I thought might be unusual there. Night Eyes was as pleased to remain at home, for he disliked not only the long walk to the trade crossroads, but the dust and noise and confusion of the crowded market. I felt much the same about it, but forced myself to go anyway. We did not do as well as I'd hoped, for folk at the small market we frequented were more accustomed to trade in goods than to buy with coin. Still, I was pleasantly surprised at how many folk recalled Tom Badgerlock and commented that it was good to see me come to market again. It was the second time we went to market that we chanced to meet Haps Hedgewitch from Buckkeep. We had set our wares out on the tail of our pony cart in the market. Midway through the morning she found us there, exclaiming with pleasure at seeing Hap again. I stood quietly to one side, watching them talk. He had told me Jinnah was pretty, and so she was, but I confess I was startled to find her closer to my age than to his. I had supposed her a girl who had turned his head when they met in Buckkeep. Instead, she was a woman nearing her middle years, with hazel eyes, a scattering of freckles, and curly hair that shaded from auburn to brown. She had the round and pleasant figure of a mature woman. When he told her that her charm against pickpockets had been stolen from him before the day was out, she laughed aloud, an open, hearty laugh. Then she calmly replied to him that that was exactly how the charm was intended to work. His purse had been protected when the thief took the charm instead of it. When Hap glanced about to include me in the conversation, her eyes had already found me. She was regarding me with that expression parents usually reserve for possibly dangerous strangers. When I smiled and nodded to Hap's introduction and offered her good day, she relaxed visibly, and her smile expanded to include me. She stepped closer as she did so, peering up at my face, and I realized her eyesight was not keen. She had brought her wares to market and spread her mat in the shadow of our cart. Hap helped her arrange her charms and potents, and the two of them made a merry day of our marketing after that, exchanging news since Springfest. I listened in as Hap told her of his apprenticeship plans. When he spoke to Jinnah, it became very clear to me just how much he had wished for the cabinet-maker in Buckkeep rather than the boat-builder in Hammerby Cove. I found myself pondering if there was yet some way it might be arranged, not only the higher fee, but for someone other than myself to negotiate the apprenticeship on his behalf. Could Chade be persuaded to help me in such an endeavour? From there my mind wandered to what the old man might ask of me in return. I was deep in such thoughts when Hap's elbow in my ribs jolted me from my wandering. "Tom!" he protested, and I instantly perceived that in some way I had embarrassed him. Jinnah was looking at both of us expectantly. "Yes?" "See, I told you it would be fine with him," Hap crowed. "Well, I do thank you, as long as you are sure it would be no trouble," Jinnah replied. "It's a long road, with inns both far-spaced and expensive to one such as myself." I nodded my agreement to the statement, and in the next few minutes of conversation I realized that Hap had extended the hospitality of our cottage to her the next time she happened to pass our way. I sighed privately. Hap loved the novelty of our occasional guests, but I still regarded any new stranger as a potential risk. I wondered how long I would have to live before my secrets were so old that they no longer mattered. I smiled and nodded as they conversed, but added little. Instead, I found myself studying her as Chade had taught me. But I found nothing to suggest she was anything other than the hedge witch she claimed to be. which is to say I knew very little of her at all. Hedge witches and wizards are fairly common at any market, fair or festival. Unlike the skill, common folk attach no awe to hedge magic. Unlike the wit, it does not mark the practitioner for execution. Most folk seem to regard it with both tolerance and scepticism. Some of those who claim the magic are complete and unapologetic charlatans. These are the ones who pull eggs from the ears of the gullible, tell fortunes of vast riches and lofty marriages for milkmaids, and sell love potions that are mostly lavender and chamomile, and peddle luck charms made from dismembered rabbits. They are harmless enough, I suppose. Jinnah was not, however, one of those. She had no friendly patter of talk to attract the passing folk, nor was she dressed in the gaudy veils and jewellery that such frauds usually affected. She was clad as simply as a forester, her tunic shades of green over brown buckskin trousers and soft shoes. The charms she had set out for sale were concealed within the traditional bags of coloured fabric, pink for love charms, red to rouse lagging passions, green for good crops and other colours whose significance I did not know. She offered packets of dried herbs as well. Most were ones I knew, and they were correctly labelled as to their virtues. Slippery elm bark for sore throats, raspberry leaves for morning sickness and the like. Mixed among the herbs were fine crystals of something which Jinnah claimed increased their potency. I suspected salt or sugar. Several pottery dishes on her mat held polished discs of jade or jasper or ivory, inscribed with runes for luck or fertility or peace of mind. These were less expensive than the constructed charms, for they were merely general good wishes, though for an extra copper or two, Jinnah would hone the pocket stone to the individual customer's desire. She did a fairly lively trade as the long morning ventured towards the afternoon. Several times customers inquired about the covered charms, and at least three made purchases with good silver. If there was magic to the gadgets she sold them, it was one that neither my wit nor my skill could detect. I caught a glimpse of one of the charms. It was an intricate assembly of glittering beads and small rods of wood, and I thought a tuft of feathers. She sold it to a man wishing to attract good fortune to himself and his home as he sought a wife. He was a broad man, muscled as a ploughman, and homely as a sod roof. He looked about my age, and I silently wished him well in his quest. The market was well into its day when Baylor arrived. He came with his cart and ox and six trussed piglets to sell. I did not know the man well, despite the fact that he was as close to a neighbour as Hap and I had. He lived in the next vale and ran his hogs there. I seldom saw him. In the autumn we sometimes made a trade, a slaughter pig in exchange for chickens or labour or smoked fish. Baylor was a little man, skinny but strong, and ever suspicious. He gave us a glare for a greeting. Then, despite the close quarters, he forced his cart into place alongside ours. I did not welcome his company. The wit gives one an empathy for other living creatures. I had learned to shield myself from it, but could not close it off completely. I knew that his ox was rubbed raw by the badly fitting harness, and felt the terror and discomfort of the immobilized and sun-scorched piglets in the cart. So it was as much self-defence as neighbourliness for me to greet him with. "Good to see you again, Baylor. Fine litter of piglets. Best get some water into them and make them lively, and they should fetch a good price." He gave them a careless glance. "Now you stirring them up or taking a chance they'll get loose. Like as not there'll be meat before the day's out anyway." I took a breath and with an effort kept from speaking. The wit is more curse than gift, I sometimes think. Perhaps the hardest part of possessing it is witnessing so completely the casual cruelty of humans. Some speak of the savagery of beasts. I will ever prefer that to the thoughtless contempt some men have towards animals. I was willing to let our conversation end, but he came to inspect our trade goods. He made a small, disparaging noise, as if surprised we'd even bothered to come to market at all. Then, catching my eye, he observed heavily, "These are good piglets, but there were three more in the litter. One was bigger than these." Then he paused, waiting. His eyes never left my face. Uncertain of what he expected, I replied, "Sounds like a nice big litter." "Aye, it was," until the three disappeared.
A shame, I rejoined. When he kept his stare on me, I added,
lost while ranging with the sow, were they?
He nodded.
One day they were 10, the next day 7.
I shook my head.
A shame. He took a step closer to me. You and boy, you wouldn't have happened to see them. I know sometimes my sow ranges almost to your stream.
I haven't. I turned to Hap. The boy had an apprehensive look on his face. I noticed that Jinnah and her customer had fallen silent, their interest caught by Baylor's intent tone. I hated to be the centre of such attention. I felt the blood begin to rise in me, but I pleasantly asked my boy Hap, "Have you seen any sign of 3 of Baylor's piglets?"
"Not so much as a track or a pile of dung,"
he replied gravely. He held himself very still when he spoke, as if a sudden movement could precipitate danger. I turned back to Baylor.
"I'm sorry," I said.
"Well," he observed heavily, "that's strange, isn't it? I know you and your boy and that dog of yours range all about those hills. I would have thought you'd have seen something."
His remark was oddly pointed.
"And if you saw them, you'd know them for mine. You'd know they weren't strays, free for the taking."
His eyes had never left my face. I shrugged, trying to keep my calm, but now other folk were pausing in their business, watching and listening. Baylor's eyes suddenly ranged around the audience and then came back to me.
"So you're sure you haven't seen my pigs? Not found one stuck or hurt somewhere? Not found it dead and used it for dog meat?"
It was my turn to glance about. Hap's face had gone red. Jinnah looked distinctly uncomfortable. My anger surged that this man would dare to accuse me of theft, no matter how indirect his words were. I took a breath and managed to hold my temper. In a low, gratingly civil voice, I replied, "I haven't seen your pigs, Baylor."
"You're sure?"
He took a step closer to me, mistaking my courtesy for passivity.
"Because it strikes me odd, 3 disappearing all at once. A wolf might take one, or one the sow might misplace, but not 3. You ain't seen them."
I had been leaning on the tail of the cart. I stood up straight, to my full height, my feet set solidly wide. Despite my effort at control, I could feel my chest and neck growing tight with anger. Once, long ago, I had been beaten badly to the point of death. Men seem to react to that experience in one of 2 ways. Some become cowed by it, never to offer physical resistance again. For a time, I had known that abject fear. Life had forced me to recover from it. I had learned a new reaction. The man who becomes most efficiently vicious first is most likely to be the man left standing. I had learned to be that man. "I'm getting tired of that question," I warned him in a low growl. In the busy market, a quiet circle surrounded us. Not only Jinnah and her customer were silent, but across the way, the cheese merchant stared at us, and a baker's boy with a tray full of fresh wares stood silent and gawking. Hap was still, eyes wide, face gone to white and red. But most revealing was the change in Baylor's face. If a snarling bear had suddenly towered over him, he could not have looked more cowed. He fell back a step and looked aside at the dust.
"Well, of course, if you haven't seen them, then, well..."
"I haven't seen them," I spoke forcefully, cutting him off. The sounds of the market had retreated into a distant hum. I saw only Baylor. I stalked a step closer.
"Well..."
He backed another pace and dodged around his ox so the beast was between us.
"I didn't think you had, of course. You'd have chased them back my way for certain. But I wanted to let you know about it. Odd, isn't it, for 3 to go missing at once? Thought I'd let you know in case you'd had chickens disappearing."
From conciliating, his voice went suddenly to conspiring.
"Like as not, we've had witted ones about in our hills, thieving my beasts as only they can. They wouldn't have to chase it down. Just spell the sow and the piglets and walk right off with them. Everyone knows they can do that. Like as not..."
My temper flared.
I managed to divert it into words. I spoke quietly, biting off each word. Like as not, the piglets fell down a creek bank and were swept away, or got separated from the sow. There's fox and cats and wolverine in those hills. If you want to be sure of your stock, keep a better watch on them.
I had a calf go missing this spring,
the cheese merchant suddenly said.
Cow strayed off pregnant and came home 2 days later, empty as a barrel.
He shook his head.
Never found a trace of that calf, but I did find a burnt-out fire pit.
Witted ones,
the baker's boy chimed in sagely.
They caught one over to Harding Spit the other day, but she got away. No telling where she is now, or where she was.
His eyes gleamed with the joy of his suspicions.
Well, that explains it then,
Baylor exclaimed. He shot a triumphant look my way, then hastily looked aside from my expression.
That's the way of it then, Tom Badgerlock, and I only wanted to warn you, as neighbours do for one another. You keep good watch on those chickens of yours.
He nodded judiciously, and across the way the cheese merchant nodded as well.
My cousin was there at Harding Spit. He saw that wit whore just sprout feathers and fly. The ropes fell away from her, and off she went.
I didn't even turn my head to see who spoke. The normal movement and noise of the market had resumed around us, but now the gossip hummed with jolly hatred of the witted. I stood isolated, the warm summer sun beating down on my head just as it did on the hapless piglets in Baylor's cart. The surging of my heart was like a shaking inside me. The moment in which I might have killed him had passed like a fever breaking. I saw Hap wipe sweat from his brow. Jinnah put a hand on his shoulder and said something quietly to him. He shook his head, his lips white. Then he looked at me and gave me a shaky smile. It was over. But the gossip in the market went on. All around me the market chuckled along, healed by the prospect of a common enemy. It made me queasy, and I felt small and shamed that I did not shout out at the injustice of it all. Instead, I took up Clover's lead. "Mind our trade, Hap. I'm going to water the pony." Hap, still silent and grave, nodded to me. I felt his eyes on me as I led Clover away. I took my time at the task, and when I came back, Baylor made a point of smiling and greeting me. All I could manage was a nod. It was a relief when a butcher bought all Baylor's piglets on condition that he deliver them to the man's shop. As the sore ox and the miserable piglets left, I let out a sigh. My back ached with the tension I'd been holding.
"Pleasant fellow,"
Jinnah observed quietly. Hap laughed aloud, and even I broke a sour smile. Later we shared our hard-boiled eggs, bread, and saltfish with her. She had a pouch of dried apples and a smoked sausage. We made a picnic of it, and when I laughed at some jest of Hap's, she made me blush by saying,
"You look a vicious man when you scowl, Tom Badgerlock. And when you knot your fists, I'll not want to know you. Yet when you smile or laugh aloud, your eyes put a lie to that look."
Hap snickered to see me flush, and the rest of the day passed in good companionship and friendly barter. As the market day wound to a close, Jinnah had done well for herself. Her supply of charms had dwindled measurably.
"Soon it will be time to go back to Buckkeep Town and turn my hand to making. It suits me better than the selling, though I do like travelling about and meeting new folk,"
she observed, as she packed up what was left of her wares. Hap and I had exchanged most of our goods for things we could use at home, but had gained little in actual coin for his apprenticeship fee. He tried to keep the disappointment from his face, but I saw the shadow of worry in his eyes. What if our coins were not sufficient even for the boat builder? What then of his apprenticeship? The question haunted me as well. Yet neither of us voiced it. We slept in our cart to save the cost of an inn, and left the next morning for home. Jinnah came by to bid us farewell, and Hap reminded her of his offer of hospitality. She assured him that she would remember, but her eyes caught at mine as she did so, as if uncertain of how truly welcome she would be. Perforce I must nod and smile and add my hope that we would see her soon. We had a fine day for the journey home. There were high clouds and a light wind to keep the summer day from being oppressive. We nibbled at the honeycomb that Hap had received for one of his chickens. We talked of nothing. That the market was much larger than the first time I had been there, that the town had grown, that the road was more travelled than it had been last year. Neither of us spoke of Baylor. We passed the fork in the road that once would have taken us to Forge. Grass grew on that trail,
Hap asked if I thought folk would ever settle there again. I said I hoped not, but that sooner or later the iron ore would bring someone with a short memory there. From there, we progressed to tales of what had happened at Forge and the hardships of the Red Ship War. I told them all as tales I'd heard from another, not because I enjoyed the telling of them, but because it was history the boys should know. It was something everyone in the Six Duchies should always recall. And again I resolved to make an attempt at a history of that time. I thought of my many brave beginnings, of the stacked scrolls that rolled about on the shelves above my desk, and wondered if I would ever complete any of them. An abrupt question from Hap broke me rudely from my musing. Was I a Red Ship bastard, Tom? My mouth hung ajar. All my old pain at that word shone fresh in Hap's mismatched eyes. Mishap, his mother had named him. Starling had found him, a scavenging orphan that no one in his village would claim. That was as much as I knew of him. I forced honesty. I don't know, Hap. You could have been raider-born, I used the kinder term. He stared straight ahead now, walking steadily as he spoke. Starling said I was. I'm an age to be one, and it might be why no one save you would take me in. I'd like to know. I'd like to know who I am. Oh, I finally said, into the dangling silence. He nodded hard, twice. His voice was tight when he added, when I said I'd have to tell you about her, Starling said I had the same forged heart as my raping father. I suddenly wished he was smaller so I could catch him up mid-stride and hug him. Instead, I put my arm around his shoulders and forced him to a halt. The pony ambled along without us. I didn't make him meet my eyes, nor did I let my voice become too grave. I'm going to give you a gift, son. This is knowledge it took me 20 years to gain, so appreciate that I'm giving it to you while you're young. I took a breath. It doesn't matter who a man's father is. Your parents made a child, but it's up to you to make the man you'll be. I held his gaze for a moment, and then, come on, let's go home. We walked on, my arm across his shoulders for a time, until he reached up to clap me on the shoulder. I let him go then, to walk on his own and silently finish his thinking. It was the best I could do for him. My thoughts of Starling were not charitable. Night caught us before we reached the cottage, but there was a moon and both of us knew the road. The old pony meandered along placidly, and the clopping of her hooves and the creaking of the two-wheeled cart made an odd sort of music. A summer rain began to fall, damping the dust and cooling the night. Not far from home, Night Eyes came nonchalantly to meet us, as if mere chance had brought him out upon the road. We journeyed companionably together, the boy in silence, the wolf and I in the effortless communion of the wit. We absorbed the other's experiences of the day like an indrawn breath. He could not grasp my worry for the boy's future.
He can hunt, and he can fish. What more does he need to know? Why send one of our own off to another pack to learn their ways? We are diminished by the loss of his strength. We grow no younger, you and I.
My brother, that is perhaps the strongest reason why he should go. He must begin to make his own way in the world so that when the time comes for him to take a mate, he can provide well for her and their children.
What of you and me? We will not help him in that providing. We will not watch the cubs while he hunts, or bring back our kill to share. Are we not pack with him?
Among human pack, this is the way of it. It was an answer I had given him many times in our years together. I knew how he interpreted it. It was a human custom that made no sense, and he need not waste time trying to understand it.
What of us, then, when he is gone?
I've told you. Perhaps we shall travel again.
Ah, yes. Leave a cozy den and a predictable food supply. That makes as much sense as sending the boy away.
I let his thought hang unanswered. For he was right. Perhaps the restlessness Chade had stirred in me had been the last gasping of my youth. Perhaps I should have bought that wife-finding charm from Jinnah. From time to time I had considered the idea of looking for a wife, but it seemed too perfunctory a way to take a mate. Some did so, I knew, merely seeking out a woman or man who had similar goals and no excessively irritating habits.
Such partnerships often grew into loving relationships. But having once experienced a relationship not only founded on years of knowing one another, but blessed with the heady intoxication of genuine love, I did not think I could ever settle for anything else. It would not be fair to ask another woman to live in Molly's shadow. In all the years that Starling had intermittently shared herself with me, I'd never thought to ask her to marry me. That thought gave me a pause for a moment. Had Starling ever hoped that I would? Then the moment of wondering passed, and I smiled grimly to myself. No, Starling would have found such an offer baffling, if not laughable. The last part of our journey was darker, for the track to our cottage was narrow and overshadowed on both sides by trees. Rain dripped from the leaves. The cart jounced along. "Should have bought a lantern," Hap observed, and I grunted agreement. Our cottage was a darker hummock in the shadowed hollow we called home. I went inside and kindled a fire and put our traded goods away. Hap took a light and settled the pony. Night Eyes immediately sighed down onto the hearth, as close to the fire as he could get without singeing his coat. I put on the kettle and added a few coins we had gained to Hap's small hoard. It wasn't going to be enough, I grudgingly admitted. Even if Hap and I hired ourselves out the rest of the summer to bring in hay and other crops, it still wouldn't be enough. Nor could we both work that way unless we were resigned to our own chickens and garden perishing from neglect. Yet if only one of us hired out, it might be another year, perhaps longer, before we had saved enough. "I should have started saving for this years ago," I observed sourly as Hap came in from outside. He set the lantern on its shelf before dropping onto the other chair. I nodded at the pot on the table and he poured himself a cup of tea. The stacked coins on the table were a pitiful wall between us. "Too late to think that way," he observed as he took up his cup. "We have to start from where we are." "Exactly. Do you think you and Night Eyes could manage here for the rest of the summer while I hired out?" He met my gaze levelly. "Why should you be the one to hire out? The money would go for my apprenticeship." I experienced an odd little shift in perception. Because I was bigger and stronger and could earn more was no longer true. His shoulders were as wide as mine, and in any test of endurance, his young back would probably hold out better. He grinned sympathetically as he saw me grasp what he already knew. "Perhaps because it is something that I'd like to give you," I said quietly, and he nodded, understanding what those words really meant. "You've already given me more than I could ever pay back, including the ability to go after this for myself." Those were the words we went to bed on, and I was smiling as I closed my eyes. There is monstrous vanity in the pride we take in our children, I told myself. I had bumbled along with Hap, never really giving much thought to what I was or was not teaching him about being a man. Then, one evening, a young man meets my eyes and tells me that he can fend for himself if he needs to, and I feel the warm flush of success. The boy had raised himself, I told myself. But I still smiled as I fell asleep. Perhaps my expansive mood left me more open than usual, for I skill-dreamed that night. Such dreams occasionally come to me, more taunting my addiction than assuaging it, for they were uncontrollable things that offered brief glimpses with none of the satisfaction of full contact. Yet this dream was tantalizing with possibility, for I felt that I rode with an individual mind rather than sampling the stray thoughts of a crowd. It seemed as much memory as vision. In the dream, I ghosted through the great hall at Buckkeep. Scores of elegant folk decked out in their finest clothes filled the hall. Music wafted through the air, and I glimpsed dancers. But I moved slowly through standing folk, conversing with one another. Some turned to greet me as I passed, and I murmured my responses, but my eyes never lingered on their faces. I did not wish to be here. I could not have been more uninterested. For a moment my eye was caught by a fall of gleaming bronze hair. The girl's back was to me. Several rings rode on the slender hand that lifted to nervously tug her collar straight. As if she felt my gaze, she turned. She had caught my eyes on her, and she blushed pink as she curtsied deeply to me. I bowed to her, proffered some greeting, and moved on through the crowd. I could feel her looking after me. It annoyed me. Even more annoying was to see Chade, so tall and elegant as he stood on the dais beside, slightly behind the Queen's chair. He, too, had been watching me. He bent now to whisper something in her ear, and her eyes came unerringly to me. A small gesture of her hand beckoned me to join them there. My heart sank. Would I never have time that was my own to do as I pleased? Bleakly and slowly, I moved to obey her. Then the dream changed, as dreams will. I sprawled on a blanket before a hearth. I was bored. It was so unfair. Below, they danced, they ate, and here I was. A ripple in the dream. No. Not bored. Simply not engaged with anything. Idly, I unsheathed my claws and inspected them. A bit of bird down was caught under one of them. I freed it, then cleaned my whole paw thoroughly before dozing off before the fire again. What was that? Amusement tinged the sleepy thought from Night Eyes, but to reply to him would have required more effort than I was willing to make. I grumbled at him, rolled over, and burrowed back into sleep. In the morning I wondered at my dream, but briefly, dismissing it as a mixture of errant skill and my own boyhood memories of Buckkeep mingling with my ambitions for Hap. As I did the morning chores, the dwindling firewood stack caught my attention. It needed replenishing, not only for the sake of summer's cooking and night comfort, but to begin a hoard against winter's deep cold. I went in to breakfast thinking I would attend to it that day. Hap's neatly packed carry sack leaned beside the door. The lad himself had a freshly washed and brushed air to him. He grinned at me, suppressed excitement in his smile as he dolloped porridge into our bowls. I sat down to my place at the table and he took his place opposite me. "Today?" I asked him, trying to keep reluctance from my voice. "I can't start sooner," he pointed out pleasantly. "At market I heard the hay was standing ready at Corman. That's only 2 days from here." I nodded slowly, at a loss for words. He was right. More than right, he was eager. "Let him go," I counselled myself, and bit back my objections. "I suppose there's no sense in delaying it," I managed to say. He took this as both encouragement and an endorsement. As we ate, he speculated that he could work the hay at Corman, then perhaps go on to Dividon and see if there was more work to be had there. Dividon? 3 days past Corman. Jinnah told us about it, remember? She said their barley fields looked like an ocean when the wind stirred their growing grain. So I thought I might try there.
Sounds promising, I agreed.
And then you'd come home. He nodded slowly. Unless I heard of more work.
Of course. Unless you heard of more work.
In a few short hours, Hap was gone. I'd made him pack extra food and take some of the coins with him in case of extreme need. He'd been impatient with my caution. He'd sleep by the roadside, he told me, not in inns. He told me that Queen Catricken's patrols kept the highwaymen down and that robbers would not bother with poor prey like himself. He assured me that he would be fine. At Night Eye's insistence, I asked him if he wouldn't take the wolf with him. He smiled indulgently at this and paused at the door to scratch Night Eye's ears. "It might be a bit much for the old fellow," he suggested gently. "Best he stays here, where you two can look after one another until I get back." As we stood together and watched our boy walk down the lane to the main road, I wondered if I had ever been so insufferably young and sure of myself. But the ache in my heart had the pleasant afterglow of pride. The rest of the day was oddly difficult to fill. There was work to be done, but I could not settle into it. Several times I came back to myself, realizing I was simply staring off into the distance. I walked to the cliffs twice, for no more reason than to look out over the sea, and once to the end of our lane to look up and down the road in both directions. There was not even dust hanging in the air. All was still and silent, as far as I could see. The wolf trailed me disconsolately. I began half a dozen tasks and then left them all half done. I found myself listening and waiting, without knowing what for. In the midst of splitting and stacking firewood, I halted, carefully not thinking. I raised my axe and drove it into the splitting block. I picked up my shirt, slung it over my sweaty shoulder, and headed towards the cliffs. Night Eyes was suddenly in front of me.
What are you doing?
Taking a short rest.
No, you're not.